Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone, and we begin as we usually do on Fridays with our weekly Ask the Mayor segment, My Questions and Yours. For Mayor Bill de Blasio, you can call up right now at 212-433-WNYC. If you want to ask the mayor something, 212-433-9692, or tweet a question, just use the hashtag AskTheMayor. And good morning, Mr. Mayor. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian. How you doing?
Good. Thank you very much. First question about Amazon. I saw you say on New York One on Monday that while the deal is done to come to Long Island City, talks are ongoing with respect to some specifics. I assume this means some kind of community benefits. My question is, what specifically is still being negotiated with Amazon, and with what leverage, since you already committed to the subsidies?
Well, let's be clear, Brian, a couple of things. I mean, the reason we wanted to achieve this outcome was we want 25,000 new jobs for New York City. We want them for folks who live in Queensbridge houses nearby this site, for folks who come, you know, young people coming out of CUNY or coming out of our public schools. Almost half the jobs in tech companies do not require a four-year college degree. We want a lot more of those jobs for New York City. So that's the core reason we wanted this here. But the specific incentives that Amazon got were overwhelmingly the automatic ones that any company would get in similar situations. We have to, I think, continue to look at what we want going forward in terms of that approach as a city, as a state. But this was a situation where Amazon was able to tap into incentives that any company would have gotten. The bottom line on the additional things we can achieve. So first of all, my job is to hold them to every element of what's been agreed to so far. Public space that they'll make available, promenade, a public school building, training programs for folks in public housing, recruitment efforts, all of that. Remember, if at any point they do not keep to any element of the deal, then all of the incentives are suspended. So job one is make sure that they keep their end of the deal. Second is to go farther, to look for opportunities to get Amazon to do more for the people of Queens and the people of New York City. More job opportunities, more training, any other community improvements we can make. I think there's a lot they could do for the community. Our job is to push them to go farther.
And what leverage do you have to get something on paper? And are you planning some kind of additional announcement with some other binding commitments from Amazon as a result of these talks?
Again, what's been agreed to, it's all public. All the elements of the agreement are out there. Again, my job is to now push farther. So the agenda is straightforward to me. I want to see the maximum investment in the community by Amazon. I want to see the maximum opportunity for residents of that community, residents of public housing, residents of Queens more broadly. We're going to be pushing to get that. When you come to a basic agreement, it doesn't mean the larger discussions are over. I'm going to push them to be a positive part of the community. I'm going to push them to use their capacity to open up opportunity for people. That's an ongoing reality. I mean, look, this is a company, as big as they are, they clearly have responded previously to public pressure. Look at the fact that they agreed to do a $15 minimum wage nationwide, including a lot of places that don't have a $15 minimum wage or anything close to it. That was a result of public pressure. That was a result of political leaders telling them they had to do better. So we're going to keep doing that.
Also, you pointed out this week that right next to the Amazon HQ2 site in Long Island City, the state had done a similar project, Queens West, where it took over control from the city. But the justification for these projects is that the area is blighted, or was. Queens West was started in 1990. Is Long Island City still blighted if this kind of arrangement is going forward with Amazon?
You know, that's not the only, the answer, of course, is no, but that's not the only condition under which there are these state-city agreements. The size of this effort, there's never been an economic development deal in the history of New York City or the history of New York State that would bring in 25,000 jobs minimum, good-paying jobs, plus potential to go up to 40,000 jobs. No one's seen anything like that before. I think it will be decades before you see anything like that again.
But it means you have to have a different justification this time for the state taking control of the site from the city to bypass city council.
Again, I'm not someone who understands all the intricacies of how it's been used in the past, but I just want to note this approach, the general project plan, has not just been used in Long Island City with Queens West, which, by the way, was a great success in terms of creating housing, including affordable housing. Also, it's been used in other parts of the city, including in Midtown Manhattan. So it's not, as far as I understand the history, it's not just for one thing or another. The size of the project, the complexity of the project, the fact that city and state priorities align, that there's agreement. Remember, this only works when the city and state governments agree. And a lot of times, as you know, there's natural differences between the city and the state. But this was about bringing in this many jobs, and the only way it was going to happen was with this kind of planning approach. If it went to a ULURP approach, there's a very good likelihood these jobs would not have come here.
Let's take a call. John on Staten Island. You're on WNYC with Mayor de Blasio. Hi, John.
Hi, good morning. I'm Mayor de Blasio. I'm Brian.
Good morning, John.
My question is with regards to my daughter is in a high school on Staten Island, and she was preparing for the exam, for the APU exam, and the day before
John, which exam, John?
APU.
Advanced placement?
Advanced placement European history?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and the day before the exam, the teacher told the kid that he doubt any one of them would pass because the exam is so hard.
Well, John, I'm very glad you told me this. Let me say, when anyone calls the show, Brian, I take what they say on face value, and obviously I am a parent. I was a public school parent the whole way through with my kids' education. When I hear that, I don't like what I hear, and I'm glad John is reporting it. I don't know what happened specifically. I wasn't there. We obviously want to hear all sides of the story, but that specific idea of anyone discouraging young people from trying to achieve what they hope to achieve, that troubles me. We'll go, John, if you'll give your information to WNYC, we'll pursue this. I've said publicly before that some of what I understand about this reality comes from the stories I've heard from my own wife and what Shirlane went through in her high school. She happened to go to a primarily white high school in a community in Western Massachusetts. And she felt a lot of times that adults were trying to discourage her and not see her potential. That's not something we're going to accept today in New York City. But if you'll give us your details of how to reach you, and I'll have people follow up, and we'll look into what happened here.
John, hang on. We'll take that if you want the mayor to follow up. And Mark in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with the mayor. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Mr. Mayor, and hi, Brian. And Mr. Mayor, thank you very much for all your work. I work on the issue of homelessness and housing, and I've been a big supporter of yours and all the things you've done. But I have to say I'm a little disappointed because I think your plan to include just 5% of the units in your new housing plan for homeless families is not sufficient. And particularly with new resources coming into the city with Amazon and some other ideas that have been put forward, I know we can do better. I know that you have a commitment to do better, to really turn around the tale of two cities. And we appreciate all you've done, but we need to dig deeper. The 62,000 people who are homeless now need you to dig deeper, and people of faith and people of goodwill in the city need that you do more. And I know you can, and it would be a terrific legacy. This is not an easy problem. You didn't sign on to a problem that was easy.
And Mark, forgive me, are you asking the mayor for a particular solution, or?
Yes, I am. Thank you. Yeah, so I'm asking for you to reconsider your commitment to have 5% of the new unit of the units in your 300,000 unit plan set aside for homeless households. We think it should be 10%. 5% won't really move the needle. 10% will. Over 10 years, 30,000 new units for homeless households, along with everything else you're doing, can really make a difference. And I know you want to make a difference. We just need you to do more than you could.
Well,
you can.
Mark, thank you. First of all, appreciate the spirit of the question. Obviously, I appreciate that you're focused on the needs of the homeless, and I appreciate you understand we are trying to always come up with additional solutions. So, we have an affordable housing plan that we've built over time. We've listened to people who have said things needed to change in it. We added to it. It started out 200,000 apartments. Now it's 300,000. We added more apartments for seniors, more apartments for veterans. You're right. There's also an important element of the plan for folks who are homeless. But we feel that the balance we're striking in the plan is still the right one. The fact is that folks who become homeless in this city, we get to housing solutions not all the time, obviously, and that's we want to make sure every single person is served. But I want you to understand, it's been 90,000 people over 5 years who went into our shelter system, and we got to an ongoing housing solution, got them out of shelter. 90,000 people. We think that piece is working the way it is, and that what we need to do is create an affordable housing reality for every element of the population in New York City. So folks who have become homeless need to be served. When you say 90,000 people have been served, you can see immediately that that's a very, very substantial number of people. We also have stopped folks from becoming homeless, particularly by driving down evictions, giving folks free lawyers to stop illegal evictions. We're going to keep doing that. We're going to build on that. But I want to caution, because I talk to New Yorkers of all different backgrounds, all different realities. There's a whole lot of folks who are working, low-income New Yorkers working. They need affordable housing. There's a lot of people who are everyday New Yorkers, bus drivers, janitors, teachers. They need affordable housing. Our job is to serve people across the spectrum, and we think this plan does that. And we want a city that's economically diverse, and we do not want this ever to become an exclusive city. We've got to protect a city that has affordable housing for a whole range of everyday New Yorkers.
So to his question about 10% versus 5% set aside?
I've said it literally a few weeks ago on the show. I'll say it again. I believe our current plan is the right balance. And it's not just that 5% set aside. It's the total impact of everything we're doing. I think there's a little bit of an over-focus on this numerical disagreement, because what's actually happening goes beyond the numbers we're discussing. In other words, I understand people say they prefer, some people believe 10% is better than 5%. I say we have a 5% commitment, and look at what's happening on the ground. If 90,000 people have already been served, that is the thing that people should focus on, the actual reality, the actual product.
Controller Scott Stringer proposed this week that to fund more affordable units for the lowest income New Yorkers, the city should end its mortgage recording tax, which wealthy buyers can avoid by buying real estate in cash, and replace it with a simple transfer tax, which every real estate buyer would pay. Would you support that proposal to raise more money for affordable housing for the lowest income New Yorkers?
So it's an interesting proposal for sure. The fact is, as I understand it, the vast majority of areas of taxation, for better or for worse, have to be decided in Albany by the legislature. It's a much bigger discussion we should have someday about why that is still true, given that New York City is 43% of the state's population and the core of the state's economy, why so many things have to still get approval in Albany. But my presumption on this is that would be required. I think it's true that there's a whole new set of possibilities in Albany now that we have a Democratic state senate, which I think is fantastic for the state and for the city. I proposed a mansion tax. Not exactly this model, but a similar concept of trying to get more out of these transactions. And my goal was to use all of the money we would get from that for senior affordable housing. And I still think that's a very good idea. I'm certainly going to look at the controller's idea. It's an interesting one. And anything that will help us create more affordable housing, we're going to take seriously. But I do want to note, I think when you look at what's happening in the city and the future of the city, one of the most central needs we have is for more affordable housing for seniors. And since we already have a proposal on the table that a number of people in Albany are interested in, I do want to say the mansion tax is the thing I'll be looking at while evaluating what the controller has put forward.
Before we get off this housing thread, on lead paint and NYCHA, I understand that several cities in California have successfully sued lead paint manufacturers for paint they made 50 years ago. And the city's got $400 million for remediation. Do you know about those cases? Since NYCHA needs so much money for remediation here, would you consider filing a similar suit?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, first of all, I'm very happy that those the folks in California were able to get that money, because there's no question. This is just like the tobacco industry. It's just like the opioid manufacturers, the pharmaceutical industry. and by the way, the petroleum companies too. They all knew the horrible impact they were having. And right now we are suing the opioid manufacturers. We're suing the petroleum companies. Obviously, in the past, the city sued the tobacco industry successfully. Now, what we have to figure out is how California pulled it off and achieved it, and our law department is looking at that right now. If we can do a similar strategy, we certainly will. There may be some differences of law, one state to another. The city did attempt a lawsuit broadly on this lines back in the 90s and did not prevail. But if we can find a new way to go at those companies, absolutely we will do that.
Ida in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Mr. Mayor, I truly appreciate all you do for our city. And I wanted to ask if there's a possibility that you can send a police patrol or something, a traffic patrol, right on Prospect Park Avenue as it becomes Hamilton Parkway and the entry into the Bell Parkway. Because what is happening is that every day during my commute, I spend about 15 minutes because all the people that are mandated by the signs to turn left going into 3rd Avenue, they start merging into the Bell Park, into the BQ highway. And it happens every day and it's demoralizing. It really is. That's all I wanted to say.
Well,
and I'll take my answer offline.
Thank you, Ida. Thank you for the question. I know that location. My home in Brooklyn is very, very near there, so I know that location. And you're right, there's been problems sometimes, and we should take another look at that. Sometimes the solution is to put a traffic agent there to make sure things are addressed smoothly. So I'm glad you're raising it, Ida. Please give your information to WNYC so we can follow up. But, yeah, we're going to see if we need more of a direct approach there by putting a traffic agent there.
You know, I'm glad she asked that question because I think this happens a lot where people in particular communities around particular intersections where they want a left turn lane or they want a stop a traffic light where there's only a stop sign, whatever, sometimes don't know how to petition the city. What's the best way to go about it on that particular kind of issue?
Well, I wish I could give you the perfect answer of the mechanics of it, but I do think, let's go with the basics. Reaching out, if it's something like a stop sign, a stoplight, reaching out to the Department of Transportation, which has borough offices, that's one way to do it. I don't know enough to say if 311 can transfer folks directly to those offices, but they can certainly get the information on how to reach those borough offices for Department of Transportation. Going, of course, to city council members to let them know is helpful just in terms of getting focus. But we constantly, Brian, we're constantly looking at where's a place that needs a new stop sign, a new stoplight, a no left turn, whatever it may be. Everything about Vision Zero requires us to constantly assess where there are safety problems. And a lot of times it's everyday people. I've had, I think it's 58 town hall meetings now, and I got to tell you, there's been a number of times where everyday New Yorkers at the town hall meeting say, here's a site that is not safe enough that needs an action. And when DOT looks into it, they come back and say, we agree, that's something that really should do, we should do an additional measure. So I think it's really important for people to speak up. When it comes to traffic agents, sometimes that's the right solution, sometimes it's not. Obviously, there's, we only have so many. But it is important for people to say if a problem might be one that would be solved by a traffic agent, we need to look at it and make sure we're sending the traffic agents where the need is greatest.
Politico New York has a story this week about healthcare costs for city workers rising faster than your projections in the last contract. So it seems like it's costing the city more than you thought it would. So with new negotiations for the next contract, the article raises the question, will you propose additional ways, or it suggests the question, if you'll propose additional ways to ease the taxpayers' burden for that, like reducing Medicare Part B reimbursements or limits on early retirees or anything else. Is that on the table?
Well, I would say something bigger and broader is happening, which is as part of the agreement that we came to with the Municipal Labor Council, the idea was to not only add to the healthcare savings we had put together previously, which is now billions and billions of dollars and growing, And by the way, this is something that never happened before on this scale in the history of New York City, where you know, the city government and labor, municipal labor, came to the table, agreed it was absolutely mission critical for the future of the city to bring down the health care costs of our employees while serving them well, and came up with billions of dollars in savings. But when we made the most recent agreement a few months ago, there was agreement to also put together a working group to find additional reforms, because we knew we had to save more money. Of course, the cost of health care keeps going up. We all understand that. But beyond that, health care savings is one of the areas where we can best reduce costs in the future. But we need to do it cooperatively. So there are a lot of ideas out there that labor is proposing and the city is proposing, and we have an ongoing process to get to the next agreement.
And we also saw the city workers unions object to the New York State single-payer health bill because they prefer their union health funds. That's interesting to see public sector workers oppose single-payer, which you support, because they prefer their private insurance. What do you say to them?
Look, I think this is actually quite straightforward. Single-payer is the way to go for the future. We have a healthcare system that doesn't work for a huge number of people. We have a healthcare system that's, you know, bankrupting families. There's folks who can't get access to healthcare in a meaningful way and can't afford it. It makes no sense. So I'm a believer in single payer. I think it's amazing that we look around the world at other countries. Canada is a great example that are doing it in a very coherent way, and this country still isn't. But there are examples where there need to be exceptions and there needs to be flexibility. Look, God bless the unions that they have, over many years, fought to make sure their workers got good health care. And that puts them in a very different place than a lot of other people in this state and in this country. We need to, if we get to a plan in New York State, which I hope we could get to as early as this year, for single payer, we need to accommodate union members who have plans that work for them now. We have to figure out a way to create that flexibility, because it does not make sense for people to go backwards.
That's different than the pure Bernie Sanders, let's say, model, which would be like Canada. Everybody's in the same plan, because once you start carving out privileges for this group, privileges for that group, we might wind up with the same multi-tier system that we have today that's unfair.
Look, I don't for a moment purport to be an expert on all the nuances, but I would say this. If we're talking about a national plan, I think that's an important question, obviously, that has to be addressed. What's going to work on a national basis? But if you're talking about the state of New York, which is either the most highly unionized state in the country or one of them, and we've got plans that work for people, we have to be sensitive to that. So I don't know enough about the different models, but I know the common sense point. We don't want to diminish people's health care. We want to improve people's health care. And I have to believe we can find a balance point that respects what organized labor has achieved so far, but also extends health care to a lot of people who don't have it or can't afford it right now.
Tashawn in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with the mayor. Hi, Tashawn.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Yes, I have a question. I was trying to find out, do you know that myself and 79 other families over here in East Flatbush, Brooklyn, are facing eviction that came out of the shelter system?
Yeah. Which address, Sean, are you talking about?
250 Clarkson.
250 Clarkson. Because I've heard about several cases lately in Brooklyn that we're working on. Do you know, Tashawn, if our Department of Social Services is providing legal assistance, or legal aid is providing assistance at your building?
Yes, I have. Yes, we do have legal aid, but we're also trying to reach out for you for help, because we know that a long time ago that you promised that you were going to help the rent stabilize, people stay stabilized by doing anything such as eminent domain, and we want to know if you're going to keep your word and help us out. Because we're in that predicament right now. We need your help as well as legal aid.
Tashawn, if I'm remembering the details properly, and I hope I am, we think there are several different things that we can do. Eminent domain works in some cases. It doesn't work in others. But we start with providing the legal support from the city. And then there's a number of things we can do as well to push landlords to make sure we're protecting affordable housing. So please give your information directly to NWNYC. I believe, if my memory is serving, that there's a couple of different steps we've already put in place to protect you and your fellow tenants, but I want to make sure we're doing everything we can to help. If you give your information, I'll make sure someone follows up with you today.
Tashawn, hang on. We'll take your information off the air so you can take this further. Mr. Mayor, I want to ask you about some deleted emails of yours that showed up in a police corruption court case this week from the real estate developer Jonah Recknitz, who was a donor to you, as you know. One was Recknitz inviting you to sit courtside at a Knicks game with him, and you replied immediately by declining, but thanking him for all his help. The other asked you not to accept the resignation of former NYPD official Philip Banks, who Recknitz now says he gave bribes to. And a meeting came out of that with Recknitz, I gather. But those emails showing aspects of your relationship with Recknitz were not among the emails you turned over in the Freedom of Information request about your relationship with Recknitz going back a few years. Work-related emails are supposed to be kept by city officials. Did you delete those emails?
Brian, we turned over thousands of emails. We turned over everything that we had, everything that was pertinent. What I do is, as much as humanly possible, move email discussions or anything about the city over to the government email. It's not a perfect process, but I think it works the vast majority of the time. So, look, this has been looked at a whole lot of times. We provided everything we had. I've been very transparent about the fact that this individual, when we understood who he was, we stopped dealing with him in every way, shape, or form. Obviously, he's a very troubled person who's committed crimes and has lied incessantly. But we gave over everything we had.
When you say everything you had, how did you not have these?
Again, you know, I get lots of emails, and anything consequential, anything that has to do with government business, we try and move it over to the government side, preserve the ones that need to be preserved. There's nothing that happened here that was consequential. That's the bottom line.
Do you think that an email from a major donor asking you not to accept the resignation of an NYPD official is not government business?
Again, I think what's important to recognize here is this has all been looked at. We do our best to be transparent. We've given out thousands of emails. I don't know why people keep coming back to it, because it's been covered and covered and covered. That's all I got to say.
Well, there was a new revelation in court this week. That's why it came back to people are coming back to it.
I don't think it's a revelation. I think it's been covered many, many times over.
Why did you, or whoever did it, delete that particular email about Chief Banks?
I really don't know the specifics of it. I just told you anything we had, we turned over.
Michael in Midtown, you're on WNYC with the mayor. Hi, Michael.
Hey, good morning, folks. I've been a cyclist for over 14 years, living on 10th Avenue for all of those years. The legislation in city council to classify e-bikes and allow them to go into our already crumbling and inadequate bike lanes is just not safe. There's no bike lanes on 10th and 11th Avenues. There are other ways to address accessibility issues. There are other ways to address immigrants' rights than imposing safety hazards on the people that depend on the bike lanes that exist already. Congestion pricing needs to be part of that. Bus prioritization needs to be part of that by making dedicated bus lanes on every avenue and every two-way street. We need more bus shelters. Think about a car-free Broadway like Amsterdam does. They separate east from west traffic. I agree with City Council Speaker Corey Johnson that we need to combat the car culture here in New York City, but by making these electric machines allowed to use the bike lane freely, it's not appropriate. If you look at these folks, they don't move their legs. It's a complete moped. It's a motorcycle. And if we allow these machines to go into our bike lane, it's going to make them more dangerous than they already are.
Mr. Mayor.
Michael, I think that's a very well-argued case. And look, I think you really like the way you framed it, particularly in the beginning. One, whatever we end up doing here, and I think from what we understand right now, a lot of this has to be decided at the state level. There's a possibility some of it can be decided by city legislation, but we're still trying to sort out the jurisdiction questions. But whatever we decide, safety has to be the number one concern. And you're right, there are honest concerns about, for example, immigrant rights, but there's a whole lot of other ways to address that broader question. But the safety issue has to be paramount. And right now, I am convinced that the way that the e-bikes were being used, particularly by delivery folks, wasn't safe, and that if that happened a lot more, we'd have a problem. And we've got to figure out, it's a city that is crowded already. I agree with you also that, you know, one of the biggest things we can do is the better mass transit options to help people get out of their cars. But in the meantime, there's too many people and there's too little space, and we've got to focus on safety. That's the whole Vision Zero mentality. We've got to focus on safety. So I think your point is well taken. And as these debates go forward in Albany, in the city council, safety has to be the first question. E-bikes are not legal to be used in New York City right now, which is why the NYPD is authorized to take them and impound them, because it's not something that is governed by law at this point.
The immigrant worker supporters say there's been no documented pedestrian injury rate by e-bikes higher than regular bikes, because the city doesn't keep statistics separately like that. So maybe they just seem more dangerous for pedestrians, but aren't really, or at least maybe not. Would a solution to this, partial solution, be to have the transportation department or whoever keeps accident report stats begin to keep those numbers, so a year or two now from now you can make public policy based on knowable facts?
Look, I always want more data. We've seen in a lot of cases that data comes back, you know, either inconclusive, or one report says one thing, another says another thing, but it's certainly, of course, we want more data. But here's the bottom line. There's a common sense element to this, too, and it gets to Michael's point. These e-bikes go very fast. It's a very different reality than being on a normal human-powered bike. There's ample evidence of e-bikes going the wrong way down streets, going on sidewalks, all sorts of things that created safety hazards, driving recklessly. There's plenty of evidence of that. The difference is...
But so do regular bikes, and they say there's no documented...
But the regular bike can't do as much damage, Brian. I mean, come on. This is, again, common sense. Yeah, a car, a motorcycle, there's a set of rules. Everyone understands it. If you go the wrong way down a street on a motorcycle, you're going to be treated the same way as a car. And people don't do it.
But are these accidents actually happening, and how can we know?
They're happening, you just said, at the same rate as what's involved with regular bikes, but they cause, of course, more impact than a regular bike. The bottom line is, the common sense says, since they are being used in a way that does not resemble a full-blown vehicle, but they're not a bike that goes a lot less fast and is less impact if it hits you, something's wrong with this picture. And my view is, since it's illegal anyway in this state, we're starting with the safety first attitude. It's illegal, and it doesn't fit the equation of how we keep people safe. And there has been abuse of it, of these e-bikes, in ways that makes people unsafe, particularly for folks who have disabilities or happen to be seniors. It adds additional danger. And that's what I care about first. Mm-hmm. So I get, if people, to Michael's point, if people are immigrant advocates, there's a lot we need to do to support immigrants. We do in this city. But don't put that as the first consideration on the e-bike question. The first consideration on the e-bike question is safety.
And some people have pointed out a paradox between your position on that, as just stated, and the fact that you're okay with the pedal-assisted e-bikes that have been rolled out yesterday with the city bike expansion.
But wait, pedal assist is legal. But again, we got to sort of, everyone enjoying this debate without having the bottom line facts, because it wasn't a frontline issue for a long time. Pedal assist bikes are legal in New York City, and they have a speed limit. They have physically, they can only go so fast. And they've been something that has been valuable to folks, for example, with disabilities who need to get around. That's one thing. E-bikes go faster. E-bikes are not legal. We have to make sense of all of it, and we have to reset the entire equation in a methodical way that focuses on safety, but they're two different things.
Do you want to end today with the related good news and just talk about the city bike expansion itself?
Look, this is something that people have been talking about for a long, long time in the city. City bike has been a huge success. There's a lot of exciting possibilities ahead in terms of dockless biking. You know, it's important to recognize that more and more New Yorkers are choosing to get around by bike. That takes cars off the streets. That's good. We have to make sure they're safe. But this is more and more going to be something that reaches all over our city and gives people another transportation option. So it's real exciting.
Mr. Mayor, thank you as always. Talk to you next week.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Much more to come.